blah, blah, blah. And I was wondering, it got me to thinking that if you take a Yagi, for instance, and you dip the front of it down by 10%, as opposed to a vertical that you rotate, let's say counterclockwise, 10%, which one would have more than an advantage in the rotation, or would both of them not have, you know, would it be detrimental to do that for both of them? I mean, I know Yagis are horizontal, and I know verticals are vertical, but I'm just going on what this guy said today and wondered if there, what the pattern is, if the patterns of both cases would benefit transmission or reception. Go ahead.
Okay, number one, Yagis are not inherently horizontal. Most people use them horizontal, but they can be used vertical. There's nothing against the laws of physics that disallow that. So you could rotate the driven element and the radiators, and the driven element, the reflector, and the director at 90 degrees and have it be effectively a vertically polarized Yagi antenna. It ultimately depends upon the gain of the antenna, and the different antennas can have different gains. A simple quarter wave ground plane has a very, very small gain. But you can get these like a GP9, or Diamond has similar stacked collinears that have a higher gain. And the way that they get that way is, again, because these are all passive gains. You're not really pumping any more energy. What you're doing is squeezing down the disk of the radiation pattern. So it depends upon the gain for a given antenna. By adjusting its takeoff angle, you might get a better presentation for the repeater antenna that you're searching for. So if it's a very high gain Yagi, you'll get better if you kind of dip it and adjust the takeoff angle to something non-standard because of obstructions in your environment, as opposed to a vertical, all things being equal. So it depends upon the gain factor of the antenna, and to a lesser degree, Yagis that have a higher front-to-back ratio, so theoretically get a higher gain with them than you can even with stacked dipoles, stacked verticals.
Vertical or...
Well, again, the problem is, you know, this is kind of a visual thing. If you're actually just rotating the vertical like a top, so that effectively it's symmetrical, it's not going to make any difference. What you're talking about more is tilting it off axis, so it's not... It's not 90 degrees from the ground. Instead of being 90 degrees from the ground, it's either 95 or 85. So it's an offset. So that's a kind of a tilt more than I would call it a rotation. Because if you rotate a Yagi, Yagis have front to back, so it'll be enormous if you actually rotate that. Whereas vertical, by its nature, is unidirectional. If you rotate it around its axis, it shouldn't have any effect.
Yeah, I was talking about doing it like the second hand, you know, or the hour hand on a clock. That's what I was referring to in terms of rotation. Go ahead.
Okay, so that's a tilt. So, as I said before, if you tilt either, you will change its takeoff angle in the direction of the tilt. So say you have some, I don't know, big apartment complex a couple of blocks down, and your antenna is, a lot of it is getting absorbed by it, and the repeater that you're trying to get to has a decent elevation. If you tilt either your Yagi or your vertical up a little bit and get it past the obstruction but still don't miss the elevated antenna, then you get an increase in the signal strength of your transmission. Again, it depends upon the general gain for both the vertical or the Yagi of how much factor that is.
So it's possible with a vertical, like from Riverhead to Sheldon, to optimize it for that pathway? Go ahead.
Yes, it kind of undermines your ability to reach radios in the opposite direction, because as you bring up the takeoff angle on one side, you bring down the takeoff angle on the other side, and it kind of hits the ground almost. So there's a price to be paid, but it can benefit you if the topology of your area allows for such things.
Can you tell with your ear if there is any difference in my signal or not?
Well, the only way I can really judge it, because I can't do a signal strength, since the signal strength is not from you, it's from the repeater, is just by the quieting. You are not right now total quieting. You are, I would approximate about 20% background noise. So, it's a good signal. I think I've heard you better. I think sometimes I've actually heard you with full quieting. But it's a good signal. And the trouble is, signals change day to day, unfortunately. Sometimes I can look up at Limark and I'm receiving them at something like minus 82 decibels. Right now I'm receiving it at minus 87 decibels.
My weekly How's My Signal Doing? A question. But now that I have, I forgot what you called it, rotated it or changed the orientation of it, and it really hasn't done much of anything, might as well just put it straight up and down if I can get it that way. I'm doing this not because I want to, because something is obstructing this, the absolute vertical angle of the antenna. And but I can try, and we'll see what happens. All right, well, thank you very much. Back to you.
You're welcome, Rich. If you get yourself a radio with a good calibrated signal strength meter, that's always a good thing to play around with. You get a better idea, at least while you're testing it, for the optimum direction. It's always, unfortunately, subject to change because sometimes reflections and multipath are a good thing. Dick used to mention that he would very often, he learned the trick of bouncing a signal off of a water tower. So sometimes reflections are not bad things. But you got to find what works for you, and that depends upon the transmitter, the receiver, and the general topology of your area.
Well, I don't know if Sheldon... does anybody know the altitude of Sheldon? Vis-a-vis the rest of the land mass around it? Go ahead.
Yes, Lou.
Yes, Sheldon is about at least 300 feet in elevation, plus the tower. I don't know how tall the tower is, but maybe it's another 50, 300, I don't know. So you're up there, but the land itself is around 3.
All right, thanks, Lou.
Okay, Rich, I continue to wish you good luck on this project, and I understand you have your eye on a reconditioned radio. I wish you luck with that.
Yeah, if anybody has an old 2-meter radio with some power, because I'm dealing with just 7 watts, please let me know. I'm good in QRZ. Thank you.
Okay, very good, Rich. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and this is the Limehawk Technical Net. So if anyone has any questions of any technical nature, science topics, what have you, just kind of bring them out here, and we'll discuss them. So if anyone has any questions, please give me your first name and your call sign. Yes, John. What is your comment or question for tonight?
My question has to do with something called delta modulation. I remember reading an article, about 15, 4 years ago, either in QES, where some people delta modulation. That's where you just jump up or jump down to track the analog signal. I was just wondering if anybody has been experimenting that will do it, a command log signal coming in. So I'm just wondering if there's any experiments going on with the...
So, good old Google. Delta modulation is an analog-to-digital and digital-to-analog signal conversion technique used for transmission of voice information where quality is not of primary importance. In delta modulation, it says the transmitted data is reduced to a 1-bit data stream. So that's interesting. I don't know if it lends itself the way that it's described here for much commercial use, because I would think that they were interested in the quality of the voice information. But if anyone out there has any knowledge of any developments in delta modulation, please share. I think that was Wesley, but you're a little bit fast on talking and a little bit slow on push-to-talk. So hit the push-to-talk, wait a second or two, and try again.
Right. In automation, in automation, people are dealing with digital. Then at some point, might need to convert it back to analog. It depends what part of automation system is kind of signal. So the point of it was automation. But then some people say, how about you look at the Morse code that is extremely easy. Put data, but it takes a time, too much time. How about if I do something with it and try to apply it to some form of the device as it needs some signal? So that was the third of it. That's why the accuracy was not needed, because the bandwidth that was required for it was not the good one. And to actually...
Okay, I'm just wondering whether there's much in the way of development, because, you know, I would assume you could buy a digital-to-analog converter for about 2 cents, depending upon the resolution and the depth of each bucket, if you will. So I wonder if there's a heck of a lot of work going into that technology right now.
Begins with a comment.
Okay, there is something about the sampling rate. So the major difference between Morse code and the delta modulation is a bit rate. It is being called Nyquist rate. And that is used to achieve better sampling. If the sampling interval is differential PCM and it's reduced considerably to the some other form, which could be sample to sample, amplitude difference, and it's very small, then we have, if we have a difference of 1 bit quantization, that a set size would be very small. And the goal here is just to sent as much as possible of information that doesn't need to be accurate in very short period of time. Enter exit.
Okay, thanks, Wes. John, you wanted to say something.
The interesting thing, there are a couple of chips on the market that'll do it. The MC3417 or MC3418 will do continuous variable step size delta mod. And I just want to make sure that I think Wesley is thinking of the complete analog to digital conversion. This is not a sample converts the sample to binary number type digitization. This is just following an analog signal by sending a jump up, which is logic 1, or a jump down, which is logic 0, signal at a regular fast clock rate to track what the analog signal is doing. So it's not to be confused with the whole digitizing process of sample and then converting to a 8-bit number. So it's different than that. Go ahead.
Comment.
Yes, Wesley?
Here I have, I need to explain something. We talk about early stage of building a house, and then we have a foundation. And then some people imagine how that foundation could be used. Because they lost all of the information, what should be there. So we have a foundation. And somebody come with the idea of something, and the other guy come with the idea of something. That's how the system is being born. But then, when we hit 10th floor, we have a quite concrete structure. So we're talking about something that was at the beginning, something that is later. It's a different animal. Let me drop. Delta modulation, the type of modulation where the sampling rate is much higher, and in which the step size after quantation is of smaller value delta. Such modulation is termed delta modulation, future of delta modulation, I'm reading. Following are the strong features of delta modulation. An oversample input is taken to make full use of signal correlation. The quantization design is simple. The input sequence is much higher than the Nyquist rate. The quality is moderate. The design of modulator and demodulator is simple. The staircase approximation of output waveform and the step size is very small. And this is an example delta. So, the bit rate can be decided by the user, and this involves simply in the implementation. So, as I said at the beginning, it's not about accuracy, but it's about complicity. If you have a simple message like in automation, that's how the technology was born, then you can send them. But then somebody say, hey, how about if I do something else with it? The major difference is you can send a lot of information in a very quick period of time, much quicker than Morse code. Enter H here.
NY2H?
Yes, Lou.
All right, so my quick read of the wiki page, the Nyquist rate has to be a lot higher, but it's not just used in automation. It was used in the 80s in satellite for telephone circuits. So they had, you know, scores of telephone circuits, and again, telephone quality, you know, POTS quality, isn't that high fidelity, so it worked very well. The rate of this one or zero signal is significant, and it indicates when this delta crosses the threshold, so you can basically convert or take that pulse width modulated stream. Again, one, it's not 8 bits, it's 1 bit, really, either on or off, a one or a zero, in a pulse width fashion, just like you'll dim an LED light or change the apparent amplitude of that light, but it's a little bit different because the pulse width change is precipitated by passing a boundary. So, you know, again, it's the only thing it requires is a faster sample rate, but it's good enough for phone circuit quality.
Yeah, I have addition to that. It was automation. The switching network of telecom company was requiring a pitch in a certain form to be sent to switch. It was automation. But telecom company said, hey, it's very useful for us and we're going to keep it and switch it.
Okay, I mean, Wes, that's the nature of a lot of discovery, where you design something for one purpose and then some clever person realizes that you can repurpose it for other things and do things that you couldn't do before.
The EH was calling.
John.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting aspects of it, I guess you could call it one of its distortion features, was that it was a picture of something called slope overload, where the signal rate of change, analog signal rate of change, as the Delta mod making these little step up, step down, couldn't keep up, couldn't track analog signal. So they went to something called continuous step size Delta mod. And these chips, as I mentioned, Motorola 3417, 3418, will do this, and it will do it for voice. So that's why I was just wondering if anybody was out there playing around with it for radio use, if anybody was doing it. That was my only question. Anyway, thanks for the time.
You're welcome, John. I would think, though, in order to get around the bandwidth limitations, even if you could get it to work and if it had any particular benefit over a regular DAC, you would still probably need to have some significant vocoder compression algorithm to run through the digital. Otherwise, your bandwidth would be humongous.
Yeah, I know the clock frequency on it has to be much greater than the sampling rate. Like with normal voice, limited hertz, you get away with sampling at 8 kilohertz clock frequency, a lot higher, much greater than you're making these little jump ups and jump down back to signal. It's an interesting mode having these chips out there. Sounds like something I might play around with this summer, because I got these chips a couple of years ago, and I'll play around with it this summer if I can try high. Back to you.
Okay, very good, John. And please, if you get him to do anything interesting, come back and tell us about them. I would be fascinated.
Will do.
Okay, once again, this is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Limewalk Technical Mess. So if you have any particular topics of discussion you would like to roll around, or questions of a technical nature, or questions of any kind of scientific aspects, now's a good time and place to do it. Just hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
Question. I don't quite understand. Why is this so inefficient? So what's keeping them from getting a better efficiency on solar power?
Obvious sign. Of it to squeeze out some additional power. Also, you have to realize that most solar cells are optimized for certain frequencies, and the sun has a wide spectrum of frequencies, so a lot of the light is simply lost because the energy transfer technology can't be optimized for all the frequencies at the same time.
The difference in frequency makes a lot of sense. I hadn't really thought about that. It's interesting. It's so inefficient. There's so much power there. You can't harness that. There's got to be a better way. But interesting. Well, you touched on part of the article said that's exactly partly how they're going to increase the efficiency is using more of the bandwidth, I guess, or more of the different spectrum to try to get power. But I kind of looked at it as we're only getting 20% of the part that they're utilizing, so I didn't realize they're not utilizing much of the spectrum.
Wesley, did you want to add something?
Yes. It reminds me of the progress that I saw since 1982 in automation that was CNC machines using perforated tape, paper tape, and then they tried to switch to DTMF. That was mostly used in telephony. Later on, but at the same time, telephone companies found that DTMF is good, and Trimble navigation GPS services were trying to implement that into communication with the GPS control devices. And then later on, they find out that, wow, we have a delta modulation. And that is much faster, much better. And soon after that, it was replaced by motor chips using fully digital technology. And then later on, they find out, well, how about if we use fiber optics? And now we have intuition.
That's very good, Wes, but we kind of left that subject. We've been discussing why a report of 50% efficiency for a solar cell is a dramatic improvement and why solar cells as a technology have a relatively low efficiency.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that. I was outside of the house for a moment. I apologize.
DBH with a question on solar efficiency.
WS2N.
Small ranges in the electromagnetic spectrum that have a high percentage of energy or have a broad spectrum in which you do a mediocre job across the spectrum. So this particular assessment is the focus in at a certain, I think it's infrared, they're working in gallium arsenide and such. So, you know, everyone and their brother is working on solar energy conversion. You know, if they could crack that nut and make it more viable, it could improve the amount of, energy that is replaceable. But you know, they're still working on it. It's all material science. Fascinating. All kinds of interesting materials they're working with. And usually every other article that I read about this inevitably talks about graphene.
WS2N.
Appreciate it. It's an interesting topic. I'm not all gung-ho on solar as many people are, but it just got me thinking about why it's so inefficient. Anyway, thank you. K2SDP.
WS2N.
Something?
Did you call me? AC2GS, WS2N?
Yes, indeed, Paul. You wanted to say something, so I was letting you know that you could speak now.
Okay, right. You know, I kept doubling with Chris. So that's very good. Yeah, Dick used to talk about the amount of watts that you would hit a square meter, and it's 1,300 watts per square meter from the sun on Earth. You know, if you go above the atmosphere, it's more. The atmosphere knocks out some of that. But, you know, what I mean by 50% efficiency or, you know, 25%, you know, of what? I mean, you know, if you take a 1 meter square, you know, panel, you're going to be able to get, let's say, 600 watts off of that. I don't think so. that would be, to me, 50% efficiency. If you're going to go, actually, 650 watts would be 50% efficiency. Well, you know, what do they mean by that? You know, I don't see where they're getting that number. There's no way. Maybe, you know, 40 watts or 50 watts or something, but you're not going to get 600 watts.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. That's the report. Usually reports tend to be optimistic to begin with. So you take it from there and then you downsize it. But, you know, any new technology might get you some incremental improvement in efficiency. Popular in different places. They have pluses and minuses. If they get dirty, their efficiency drops. So, you know, at most, a lot of times, the spec efficiencies are for a nice, clean array that's positioned in the right direction to the sun and such. So, it's all interesting. You know, I mean, there's articles like this about new battery technology. That was the story right before the solar cells on my list I have up on my list. And so, you know, I mean, it's always good that they're looking into it. I don't know whether they'll reach any of this, but those are kind of theoretical limitations. They're not the practical limitations as far as I can figure what they wrote.
Okay, well, you know, Hubble, when that went up, they had big solar panels. And 3 years later, when they went up for the first service mission, one of the things they did was get rid of those solar panels. They just pushed them off and let them burn up in the atmosphere. And they replaced them with new solar panels that were about one-third shorter, but they had like twice the amount of energy. And I remember they said it had to do with gallium arsenide that they were using for them. So, you know, there's been improvements. 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago, they had the solar panels for the space station. And now, right now anyway, presently, over the next few years, they're going to be replacing or adding to those solar panels. The panels they're putting up are half the size and putting out, you know, the same amount of wattage. So essentially, they've doubled the efficiency in over 20 years, about 20 years ago. There is an improvement. Back to your work.
Yeah, it's incremental. In the old days when we were young, solar cells were silicon-based devices about 20 years ago, I think. Indium gallium arsenic became the solar panel material. Now they're working with indium gallium arsenides and indium gallium phosphates and other new materials that have somewhat better efficiencies for energy transfer. So, you know, it's a process. It would be nice if a book from the future, a nice technical cookbook, dropped down someplace and saved people a lot of time and effort in experimenting. But that's the nature of material science. You keep on putting things together and seeing what the new product is capable of. First John, then West. So, John first.
Yeah, I think Paul had the same question I had relative to that insolation, the incoming solar radiation of 1,300 watts per square meter. Is that wasting their fish? That, or is it something else? So that's a good question.
No, they just talk about chasing 50% efficiency. They don't really say what that means. I assume that experimentally, if you produce a broad spectrum light emission with that amount of energy, you can recover 50% of it. But, you know, I mean, even for all intents and purposes, there's a lot of thermal energy that gets dissipated in solar cells no matter what you do. It's just going to radiate infrared just from their temperature alone. So there's an inherent limitation in the amount that could be absorbed. It's somewhat reminiscent of what Dick used to mention about receiving antennas, that there's only a maximum amount of energy it can absorb, because half of the absorbed energy gets re-radiated by the antenna itself. So I guess there's that going on as well in the equation.
Yeah, I guess the second law, better than that, which applies here to the first 100 electrical energy. Hi.
Yeah, I would agree. So there must be some kind of part of some equation where what they're talking about, the sample amount and how much can be converted, which I'll take a look, Google it around, and try and figure out exactly what they're alluding to. It's kind of taken as a fait accompli here with most of these articles, you know, especially, like I mentioned before, you look up photosynthesis, and you'll see that there's two types of photosynthesis. One's a little bit more efficient than the other, but both of them are still...
Oh, you dropped out at the end there.
Wesley, I got this that you wanted to say something.
Yeah, you see that. Okay. The few last words that you said, Benny, from the amount of heat delivered. So, we compare most of the articles, the official articles, and the 6 cents, in between the different manufacturers. When we say that heating system based on solar water heating efficiency is 64.9, and that was from December to April of 2015, there was an investigation made by Saudi Arabian scientists, and they were doing it in Tunisia. So what they find out, they employed a program called Turner 16. And they were trying to do simulation and compare the simulation to the results from the observation. So they find out that the cost and the efficiency of the system were estimated for different size of greenhouse, the size, and concluded that heating cost of 1,000 cubic meters greenhouse was reduced by 51.8% in April in Tunisia. The result of the study was that the water panel system is much more efficient than the solar one. And my question to you is, why do we use solar panels?
Well, I mean, part of it is political, but people use solar panels theoretically to decrease ever so slightly the non-replaceable power that we get from fossil fuels. So everyone's looking for replaceable, recyclable power, and if you could get the efficiency of solar panels up, that might be a viable solution in some places. To certain degrees, things have been getting better. They've gotten the efficiency somewhat better over time. But do I think that that's going to be the ultimate solution to our problem? I don't think so. I think we're going to have to take a kind of eclectic view towards providing replaceable energy using geothermal and wind and all kinds of fun stuff. I mean, in a perfect world, I wish we could look into the more esoteric versions of nuclear power and see if they might be productive. It would be nice if we could do fusion, but that's always about 10 to 20 years in the future, no matter what year you're talking about.
Question and one YDY.
Well, talking about 15, 20 years, I spoke to a few mathematicians, comment like that, and do me a favor. If we had no problem with energy course, to be easily accessible and very much inexpensive, what would happen with the population? So a few weeks later, I've got the results, sending that 18 years from now, we would experience overpopulation, starting of overpopulation. Chinese are allowed right now to have a second child, and possibly a third one, with some limitations. And we're talking about energy and the problems with the energy. We're talking about the human race need to expand. It would be trashing off our natural resources. Am I right? And to achieve.
Well, I mean, this goes all the way back to Malthus, where he predicted that we would die a terrible death of overpopulation a couple hundred years ago. Somehow we figure ways of getting around it and breed like rabbits. So eventually, yes, all this will come and we'll have to pay the piper. Eventually we'll reach the limitations. We have been repeatedly lucky. We have gone through the Green Revolution, in which food production has increased by multiples in the last decades. And so we can feed the world, whereas, you know, based on the technology of 50 years ago, we would have starved by now. So if you extend different different things that maintain populations and extend populations, you'll get larger populations until the rubber band breaks. When that's going to happen, I don't know. Again, Malthus thought it was going to break a couple of centuries ago, and he wasn't particularly right.
And one YDY question.
I know you want to ask something or say something. So, Hank, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, when you have a moment, I'd like to get back to the solar panels. I have a question about them.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Thank you. I was reading somewhere that solar panels lose efficiency over time and have to be replaced on a time basis, whether or not they're in storage or actually in active use. And I was wondering if, when we talk about renewable fuels, renewable sources of energy, that we take into account the amount of coal that's expended in creating the high temperature furnaces that are required to actually make the solar panels and convert the silicon into a surface that's usable.
Well, that's a very good question, and I tend to think that the guys who write articles about the brave new world of these technologies don't really take that too much into mind, or they kind of wax over it and say that over time the durability and such will make the cost of manufacture less important. But a lot of these new technologies that we're looking forward to have a enormous price carbon footprint of manufacturing. All these battery stations that have, you know, lithium ion have a terrible cost. Lithium is not all over the place. You have to mine for it, and then you have to manufacture it, and there's a lot of industrial use. So a lot of these methods that we're thinking of in terms of renewable resources are linked to not-so-renewable resources. So I would agree with you that certainly is a factor, and I'm sure one of the many things that material science people are working on is some kind of solar panel material possible or not. You know, only the future will tell.
So, I just want to say that the topic has been really long.
Don, thank you very much. If you ever have anything that you want to add to the mix or questions, feel free to break in with your call sign, and we'll recognize you. David, it's KG2RY. You wanted to say something as well on this.
Good evening, Roy. Thank you very much. I want to say that, first of all, most of the experience I've had with solar panels were to power up a trickle charge, a scooter battery or car battery or whatever. From my experience, you know, the efficiency shouldn't be so important because a trickle charge is very small. Then I thought about what you guys were saying about overpopulation in the environment, you know, that people complain about gas-guzzling cars, the petroleum pollution, and they're driving their big, expensive, gas-guzzling cars to the protest. I guess the question that I have is, in terms of the possibility of bringing down the level of pollution in the world, that constructing cars that are electric and powering them up with electric power, and how those stations get powered, and how much pollution that creates. My question to you is that also part of this?
Well, you know, as Hank mentioned in the case of solar batteries, and I mentioned in electric cars, unfortunately, you really, if you're legitimately making a case for it, you have to include the infrastructure and the manufacture of the items that you're going to use. In a perfect world where electricity runs cars and there's no internal combustion and there's no carbon monoxide and smog being generated by the tailpipe of a car, that's wonderful. But the problem is, something's got to give someplace. In order for the electric motor to work, you need a storage device. Batteries, unfortunately, technology and battery technology is slow as heck. You know, we're still on lithium ion. They're working on some other technologies, but there doesn't seem to be some amazing thing coming any minute. Lithium, as I mentioned before, is not an abundant element. It's difficult to find. Only some areas you can mine for it. And then the mining operation is going to screw up the environment there. Then you have to process it. And then you got to get rid of it when it's no longer useful, hopefully recycling it rather than just throwing it into some pit someplace. And the power source to charge these is all important. If you're getting the power source by a standard generator that's burning natural fuel and gas and such, well, then you just shove in the gas someplace else. So you need to discover some kind of method that's cleaner to produce electricity at local generators that then feed the communities and recharge cars. So without an infrastructure that's also doesn't entail too much of ecological disaster, you got to factor that into the equation, unfortunately. A lot of people like to separate them because it's easier that way, but life ain't easy.
QSL, Roy. But, you know, how much carbon you have to put to waste, the amount of carbon it takes to build an electric car, you know, the pollution that creates as compared to, you know, the amount of pollution of car that runs on petroleum will produce, maybe in a lifetime or in the lifetime of the car. So, yeah, you know, we still have a long way to go. AG2RY, thank you.
You're welcome, David. Well, yeah, ultimately with electrical cars, the overwhelming factor is battery technology. If you can discover, as one of my stories for tonight discussed, an alternative for lithium that's more available and safer for the environment, then it brings down the ecological cost. If you're stuck with lithium ion, then you're stuck with lithium ion. But that's the primary gotcha in electric cars. The batteries are not that different. The motor. Electrical motors aren't that incredibly different than internal combustion motors. So the cost of producing them and the environmental impact are reasonably similar. So it's the batteries that are the big gotcha, and people, as I said before, are working night and day on improving battery technology, whether or not they find something that's incredibly different than what we have today. Only the future can tell us.
This is KXL. I just want to put my input on this. I actually drive an electric car, and I know that at night, what electric cars can do is they can charge off the grid. It's called a duck curve, so it also can help mitigate that.
Okay, unfortunately, you're about 50% noise. I can hear most of it. Electricity production, electricity storage. I think that they did a story in either Long Island or Queens where they're going to just build a massive storage battery facility. You know, the capacities of those things are not... I don't quite know if they're terribly cost-effective either. Again, battery technology is not as good as I would wish it to be. But, you know, what can I tell you? I think we got spoiled by solid-state electronics. The improvements over the last 50 years have been beyond the term dramatic, whereas batteries have been gradual, constant but gradual. So, unfortunately, we got to live with what we got. Once again, anyone else on this subject before we turn to something completely different?
N1YDY, something else?
Yeah, sure, Hank.
So, on the internet, you can see that there are a number of wind farms, the wind generators that are up on poles, that have been abandoned out west. And some of these, especially the ones in Australia, for example, have gotten to the point where the operators have walked away from them and left the things to literally rot and fall apart, some of which are on leased land from farmers, and the farmers are complaining that the operator isn't coming back to remove this thing at the end of its service life. So I wonder what we can do as a country. Again, talking about renewable resources, and quite frankly, an alternative source of energy, with the carcasses of things that have reached the end of operational lives.
How much can you recycle? The problem is recycling is a great concept. But practically speaking, I don't know the specifics because I'm not involved in the technology. But, you know, I've seen more than a few cartoons about how people go and separate their garbage into 15 different containers, and then the garbage man puts it on one pile and drives away with it. I tend to think that that's not exactly what goes on, but a little too much of it goes on. So... I definitely think work should be done on recycling. There's probably a lot of useful material, except for the plastic. The problem is we're drowning in plastic, and you know, the concept of microplastics is a big topic, and is probably going to be something that people are going to be complaining about for centuries to come. Because one of the bad things about plastic is one of the good things. It doesn't degrade, or most of them don't degrade. And so we're going to be stuck with little fragments of plastic all over the place for centuries to come. But, yeah, it would be nice if we could recycle this and turn it into something useful. But it's sort of surprising when you look up the percentage of stuff that actually gets recycled. It's not a big percentage, unfortunately.
Well, I'm not arguing that, but I'm talking specifically about the large steel towers that these wind turbines were mounted on that are being left on the lands that were leased to put them up on after they've reached the end of their service life. The operators are walking away and leaving the steel and the blades and the whole thing to be dealt with by the landowner when that wasn't the original agreement in the lease. And what happens is, at least Australia, that I was reading about and watched a couple of YouTube vids, and then I found some stuff that I could actually read that suggested that these companies were setting themselves up in a way when their farms or wind turbines reached the end of their operational life, they would shut the company down, and therefore they'd be left for the farmer to come back with the landholder back and demand.
Oh, that's a shame. So basically, it's a con. The problem is that when any industry starts up, there's inevitably a bunch of guys who are in on some kind of a con in one form or another. So you know, it's a shame. I would imagine if it's a significant situation, the local government would kind of step in despite the fact that they signed a contract in another way. Or, you know, I don't know what the recover value of the material versus the labor and the process to recover it is, whether anyone would make a profit. I would assume if it was a profitable situation, there would be some Aussie out there who would, you know, go with a couple of trucks and a smelter and make some money off of it. But my guess is that when they do the math, it's not worth the trouble.
Well, that certainly would suggest that it's not economically viable for a third party to come along and help recover those metals and take these things. But anyway, my point was just, I'm trying to suggest that a lot of, like you say, the con, a lot of these things aren't built in irresponsible ways, and that at some point, I think governments have to step into what happens in the future allows for or ends the economic removal of these things at the end of their service life. Anyway, end of my little preaching.
Oh, DDH would comment.
John.
Yeah, this is the similar case that happening with solar panels. If you get a solar panel installation on your house, I don't think you get any information about the length of life of the panels, or that maybe you might have to replace the panels, or about the lifetime of the
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Someday they're going to need that roof to be replaced. So now what are they going to do? They're going to have to have these panels removed first. Roof done, you know. I mean, the roofs only last, what, 15, 20 years, right? The most. Next thing you know, you need a new roof sooner or later. And now you're going to have to pay somebody to put the panels back on. So, you know, there's some kind of a extra cost here that I don't think they're thinking about when they sell them the job like that. And by the way, if they're just leaving 300-foot structures up in the middle of Australia, was it? They need to have some kind of escrows, some kind of a funding when you put the stuff up, you know, just to pay for when it's time to take it down. You know, they've got to do something like that. That's terrible. Back to you.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Well, you know, the problem is the government is kind of a two-edged sword. Yes, they could regulate things and make things work a little bit better, but they also could be the cause of some of this problem as well. You know, they could kind of ease the manufacturer's requirements to kind of motivate them to do something that superficially sounds like it's very good for the environment, and they offer subsidies and such. So it's effectively your tax dollars paying for you know, your solar cell or your wind device and such. So, you know, sometimes it's well-meaning, sometimes it's not so much well-meaning, but the government kind of works two ways. So more regulation is good, But I'm willing to bet you there were at least a few politicians back then who said, well, but that's going to slow down progress, and we must have progress.
Okay, I agree with that. Going back another to a different topic with the acceleration or development of the batteries. You know, years ago, everybody talked about Moore's Law and how the electronics was always doubling every 18 months. Well, the batteries were not, you know. They were...